for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Senator Max Baucus says he expects amendments to the health care plan he unveiled this week. House Speaker Pelosi compares protests against health care legislation to the anti-gay rhetoric of the late 70s. And the House and Senate moved to cut off funding to ACORN. Joining me for this week's Friday News Roundup, John Dickerson of Slate.com and CBS, Cheryl Gay Stolberg of The New York Times, and Greg Ipp of The Economist. As always, your comments, questions are welcome and a very important part of the program. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org, and you can reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you. Happy Friday.
Good morning.
Good morning, Diane.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg, talk about the Baucus bill's strengths and flaws.
Well, this was the bill that was long awaited. It was the bipartisan hope. The president wanted it to be delivered before August, didn't get it, and finally it was delivered and it landed with a big thud. And that actually may be the good news, because it's got critics on both the left and the right. On the left, we are seeing criticism that the bill lacks a public option, the government-sponsored insurance plan that the president wants. On the right, and in fact on both sides, there are criticisms emerging that of the tax the bill would impose on so-called gold-plated insurance plans. This would be a tax on companies that provide very high-cost coverage.
The so-called VIP MDs.
That's right.
Yeah.
But lawmakers in both parties are concerned that those costs would be passed on to consumers and that the bill would not, in fact, provide the kind of affordable coverage that that's necessary.
So, John Dickerson, did the bill really try to seek that broad goal of health care reform?
Well, it depends on your definition of that. No, it didn't seek to achieve as much reform as possible if your definition is covering everybody and having subsidies so that not just, you know, the very poor are covered in Medicaid. Those just outside of Medicaid will be helped by subsidies. It's working families that are in trouble not only because of the tax that Cheryl was talking about, but also because the subsidies are low in the Baucus bill. If you are an individual who makes $33,000, you're still going to have to pay 13% of your income in premiums. That's just too much. So they're trying to fix that. The target that Baucus did hit, at least for the moment, is that this is a bill that has been scored by the Congressional Budget Office as being deficit neutral and, to use a cliche that's popular in Washington right now, bending the long-term cost curve. Those long-term inflation, healthcare inflation costs, those are two key goals the president put forward and said any bill must meet, and Baucus's bill does meet those targets.
Interesting that Senator Baucus stood alone, Greg Ipp, when he presented the bill.
Yeah, even though he's been negotiating with the so-called Gang of Six, you know, three Republican senators, and even though they all had substantial input into the final bill, none of them could bring themselves to actually stand with him and endorse the bill. We haven't had an outright condemnation. Olympia Snowe has specifically praised the efforts that went into it. But they have a lot of concerns still. I think that one of the pure political concerns is that even if they stood with Baucus and voted for this in the Senate, when it goes to conference with the House, it could get like shifted much more in a left-wing direction. And there they are, having given the imprimatur of respectability to something that they don't like.
Cheryl.
Yes, I think it is interesting that he stood alone, but also, as Greg said, interesting that nobody on the Republican side in that Gang of Six has actually come out and said, I will vote against this. Yet, on the Democratic side, Jay Rockefeller has said he will vote against this bill. Because it lacks a public option. He is a West Virginia Democrat. He's a very strong advocate for a government-sponsored insurance plan. He announced that he will not vote for this bill. The president promptly had him down to the White House for a private meeting. Senator Rockefeller wouldn't talk yesterday about what he told the president. I was up on Capitol Hill and tried to get a little bit out of him. And he said, no, I'm not going to talk about my private conversations. But it's he said, I'm not voting for the bill in this form. And that's important. There are 13 Democrats on the Senate Finance Committee. There are 10 Republicans. The bill has to get out of that committee in order to advance further. And they need all the votes they can get.
And yesterday, those Democrats met in the Senate Finance Committee, and they came out after these couple of days of shooting each other. And one thing that a lot of folks on the Hill are saying is, as much criticism as this bill has gotten, it's also the White House bill. I mean, it meets these targets. The president is pushing it in these private meetings. Rockefeller came out of the meeting with the Senate Democrats in the Finance Committee and said it was a very, very productive meeting, almost as if to sort of amend some of his previous remarks about it, and that he thinks that the bill can be fixed in committee. Chuck Schumer, another liberal Democrat, came out and said, we think we can get 60 votes with this thing. Now, a lot of this is public negotiation, but the mood music coming out of that meeting was better than it was when Baucus stood alone announcing the plan.
Greg.
Yeah, I think the problem for Baucus, though, is that anything he does to make it more acceptable to people like Jay Rockefeller and Ron Wyden makes much less acceptable to people like Chuck Grassley. So in order to assure that the Democratic base supports it, he actually loses the odds of having a bipartisan bill.
So he goes on 5 talk shows this weekend. How good an idea is that?
Well, I don't know. We're talking a lot in Washington about the O word, and that's not Obama. It's overexposure. The president is really putting himself out there. And there are some questions about whether or not the public will ultimately tune out. Is it the White House believes very strongly that President Obama is the best salesman it has, the best and most effective spokesman for a range of policies, certainly for health care, because he is so passionate about it.
But you know, it's that very passion that we have not yet seen, heard, felt, except in these kinds of town meetings he's done, which have not been totally covered, carried, publicized.
The passion is one part of the picture, and that's difficult to convey in that talk show setting. So that'll be one challenge. But there's another challenge for the president. Cheryl said they believe that he's the best salesman. They look at the White House at polls that say if people hear the president, they sign on. That's their polls. If you look at 2 polls that came out this week, one from CBS News and one from The Washington Post, CBS polled the people who actually listened to the speech. A lot of people thought they got new details from the president, which is a win for the White House. But of those who listened to the speech, 70% of them thought there's nothing in this health care bill for me. One of the key goals for the president in the speech was to convince people there was something in the bill for them. So that's a problem. The Washington Post had a poll in which more people said that the more they heard about the plan, the less they liked it.
It's interesting. We're going to do a show on this on Monday on the health care plan, what is in it, what is not in it. How appealing is this plan to the broad public, Greg?
I think there's a large chunk of people who are not largely affected because they get to keep the insurance they already have. There's a group of people who don't have insurance because they can't afford it, who will be moved into the category where they can afford it, either because they now qualify for Medicaid or they'll get these subsidies. But then there's a large group of people, and they're mostly young, healthy people who don't have insurance or have very modestly priced insurance, who will have to pay penalties that they didn't have to pay before. That is essentially a middle-class tax by any other name. And so going back to this issue of Obama's charm offensive, one of the reasons he went to the University of Maryland this week was because that's the demographic that is very key in some sense to getting the public on side. These are people who, by and large, voted for him in the last election, but also are probably asking themselves the toughest questions about what they have personally to gain from this reform.
But there's another reason he went, and that he's been doing these kinds of public campaign-style rallies, and that is the imagery. We spent all of August watching conservative protests at town hall meetings against, quote-unquote, Obamacare. The White House needs to counter that with a perception that people are for this, that they're excited about it, that they're enthusiastic. So what do? They send the president out. to these rally settings. He's still very popular, public approval ratings notwithstanding. He's still a very popular president. People will turn out to see him. And the White House now has these images of screaming, cheering people rallying behind the president. They want to, some of it is about perception.
How much of the difficulty the president has had getting this health care bill shaped in a form that he wanted it to be shaped in has been because Republicans were out there in such huge numbers trying to make sure he failed.
That's clearly part of the picture, and the Republicans were given more time by Max Baucus. Max Baucus took a long time to try and put together this bipartisan bill. He didn't get bipartisanship. During that period where the president had no single plan he could defend, he was left defending against claims about all of the various bills. Specificity helps the president. They certainly hope that at the White House. But part of the problem also is that there's a disconnect here. People want the reforms the president is talking about in the 70%, sometimes 80%. They agree with the diagnosis. They don't agree with his cure. They either don't agree with it in specific, those specific proposals, or some they do, some they don't, or they are right there with the president and they agree with his cure, but they don't think that government or Congress can deliver.
I think John makes an excellent point about this misgivings about the role of government here. One of the things Republicans have been successful at is tapping into a deep level of discomfort among the American people about how much more involved the government has become in the economy in the last year. You know, Obama rightly points out this has been by necessity. The government didn't buy stakes in banks and General Motors and Chrysler because they wanted to, but to prevent a catastrophe. But there you have it. The government's involved there. There is a very large fiscal stimulus plan which extended that involvement further. And I think when you layer that on, along with the very large deficits, the government people are a little bit uneasy about health care and other new ways of the government interfering in their lives.
Greg Ip of The Economist, Cheryl Gay Stolberg of The New York Times, John Dickerson of Slate.com, and CBS. We'll be right back. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup, and we are welcoming your questions, comments, 800-433-8850, and your email to drshow@wamu.org. Greg Ip is U.S. Economics Editor for the magazine The Economist. I want to ask you about Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke's statement that the recession is likely over, but it's still going to feel like a very weak economy for some time. Were there more signs of recovery this week, Greg?
Yes, there were. We saw evidence that, for example, retail sales actually rose in August, first time by that amount in quite a few months. Industrial production has risen. Now, interestingly, Bernanke said that on a technical basis, recession has probably ended. Now, he's a Fed chairman, but he actually doesn't get to make that decision. That decision is made by a committee of academics. But it's a little known fact that before he joined the Fed, Bernanke was on that committee. So he has some sense about what goes into that decision. Interestingly, one of the range of factors people look at when they make the decision about when the recession has ended is employment. And it's still going down. And it's for that reason if no other, that people will feel for some time that this we are still in a recession, even though on a technical basis the economy is actually growing.
So it's improving, but not quite enough to spur hiring.
Right, exactly. And one of the reasons Bernanke is so closely watched, we've all watched Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan would speak and people would stop whatever they were doing. It's even more the case, I think, with Bernanke. He's more powerful. The Fed is doing more now than ever before. And also, Bernanke will have to make a call at some point. And it will be before the rest of the world thinks the economy is chugging along with employment and everything. He will have to make a call to make sure the economy doesn't overheat, that all these measures that he's taken don't increase inflation. That he'll make that call before a lot of people think he'll do it, probably before people think it's time to do it. And he'll face a lot of political pressure. And everybody's watching him to see if he doesn't make that call in time, he'd risk the chance of a double dip recession.
Sure. Well, I was thinking that we just got done with the discussion of health reform, and the recovery has political implications for the president and for his agenda. Bernanke says it will feel like a weak recovery. It's clearly, so far, a jobless recovery, if you can even call it a recovery. And this is creating that sense of unease that John spoke of before. It's why the people who already have health insurance are kind of worried about this plan. They don't want anything to sort of upend the delicate balance of their lives. So people are still feeling very uncertain, and that makes it harder for the president to pass his agenda.
And at the same time, you've got President Obama calling for an overhaul of financial regulation on Wall Street, Greg.
That's right. He took the opportunity while he was in New York on the anniversary of the failure of Lehman Brothers, which vastly intensified the crisis and the recession, to essentially call for more energy being put into passing the sweeping range of financial reforms that he's put forward. One of the centerpieces of this is to create a new standalone agency to protect consumer rights with respect to loans and other financial products. He wants new power given to the Federal Reserve to look for crises. He wants to take some of the exotic instruments that got us into this mess more tightly regulated and so on. The problem Obama has had, and it's really kind of his own doing, is that by putting so much of his energy and political capital into health care, he's really taken away from the momentum of financial reform, even though people like his Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner had said early in this administration this was a priority. Mm.
And also the Europeans want it, and President Obama will be going this week to the meeting of the G20 this coming week, and this will be an issue for him. It's an international
issue.
But
how much reform is he actually calling for? What kind of momentum will he have for reform, considering everything else he's dealing with?
Well, that's the problem, is that there's an attention problem. Congress can only do so much, and the American people can only pay attention to so much. And also, things are getting better, so the sense of crisis is at conflict with, or the lack of sense of crisis.
That's worrisome.
And also, you have a situation here where a lot of the fault lines in the Senate in particular, but also in the House, are regional rather than Republican-Democrat. So he can't just, he's finding with health care, he can't do this either, but he can't just say, Democrats, let's all pass this right away. So those are some of the complexities that slow this down.
What about pay caps and that sort of thing, Greg?
That's an interesting issue because Obama wants to do more than the bankers want him to do, but less than the Europeans want him to do. Essentially, what the American approach has been is to give the shareholders of the banks more opportunity to say no to excessive pay packages. So Barney Frank, for example, in the House has passed a bill that the White House supports that would allow shareholders to have a vote on whether or not they support a pay package. It would require all members of the board of directors that have a role in setting pay to be independent of management. Now, the Europeans who will be meeting with Obama next week want to go much further. They would like hard caps on how much can be paid in terms of bonuses. They would like it to be forbidden that bonuses be paid out for less than a year's worth of performance because, that year's worth of performance could melt away in the next crisis and so on. But, a lot of this is theatrics. We are going to see, I suspect, in Pittsburgh, both the Europeans and the Americans sort of like agree on sort of general fuzzy principles that will allow both sides to go home and say they got what they wanted.
This is problematic for the president, this issue of pay caps. We saw very early in his presidency this strain of populism, him coming out and saying that bankers should be ashamed for accepting these kinds of bonuses when they're taking taxpayer bailout money. Now we're seeing the backlash. many Americans are concerned about government intrusion in a variety of policy areas. There was a huge protest here in Washington this past weekend, basically sort of a get government off our backs protest. And so I'm wondering how far the president can really push this issue of pay caps and not bump against this backlash from those who think he's doing too much government intrusion.
And we've mentioned the Europeans a couple of times, and for those who may wonder what's going on here, why the Europeans are talking about American pay, it's the interconnectedness of the economy. And essentially, and Greg will correct me if I'm wrong, but you have the U.S. saying, look, we'll take care of CEO pay so that American companies don't ruin the global economy, as a lot of Europeans think was the case in this latest crisis. And in exchange for that, we'll hope that European economies take steps to improve their economies, which are a market for U.S. goods.
All right. Let's talk about former President Jimmy Carter's comments. This week on Tuesday, President Carter said, quote, an overwhelming portion of this intensely demonstrated animosity toward President Barack Obama is based on the fact that he is a black man. And, you know, this current race debate seems to be forcing the White House to comment on an issue I think it would rather avoid.
Well, I think clearly there's no upside in the for the White House in commenting on this issue. President Obama has told his aides that he would like to be considered a president who happens to be black rather than the nation's first black president. But I do think Jimmy Carter tapped into something. His use of the words an overwhelming portion, I think many people would question whether or not there's an overwhelming portion of racism driving the criticism of President Obama. But we do see tiny threads of it. You saw it in the protest last week where President Obama was pictured on some signs as a witch doctor. There were signs saying, go back to Kenya or go back to Africa.
There was one depiction of the president in whiteface.
That's right. And this stands in stark contrast to the beautiful images that we had at his inauguration where people of all colors came together to celebrate.
So where is this coming from?
I think there's no question that we are not a post-racial society. I see it in my emails. I'm shocked by the number of emails from readers who will use the N-word in referring to President Obama, who have called him terms that I would not repeat here, racist terms, on this radio. So we know that it's out there. In how big is it? That is impossible to determine.
And I think that Obama smartly and wisely sees that part of his appeal, that what got him elected was his image, especially in the eyes of white voters, as a post-racial president. And so even though he may in his heart feel that there is an element of racism in these protests, he knows that there's absolutely no political gain for him in pandering to that.
You know, it was interesting to see and hear and watch Nancy Pelosi yesterday when she compared what's happening now in the terms being used regarding the healthcare debate, reflecting on the anti-gay movement. And of course, she was talking about the assassination of Harvey Milk.
That's right. Twice she praised the American freedom of speech. And bookended the comments you just mentioned, Diane, in which she said, I've seen what can happen when people who make extraordinary claims don't think about the ears that are hearing them. This, of course, has been picked up by conservatives. I think going back to the Carter remarks for a minute, I mean, he was delivering what I think the former president thought was a big truth. And I think actually instead of clarifying the debate as big truths can do, I think that it actually muddied it. I mean, we've talked about these strains that are clearly there in the hatred for Obama, but there's all kinds of other stuff a part of this as well. People who are angry at their government, they don't like Democrats, lots of things that have nothing to do with racism. So, and what happens is we lose the various strands and threads because once you start talking about racism, everybody moves to their corners. It's the most – in a lot of these emails we get, Hillary Clinton, you'd get some extraordinary emails too. People reach for the most vicious weaponry. It's more vicious with Obama than it is with other people. But there are other factors at play here and that get obscured once we start talking about race.
And I also think that we should keep our eye on the larger picture here, which is that while there is still racism here, the extent to which it has receded as a driving factor in politics is quite striking. If you look at polls back in the 60s versus now, the number of people who'd say they would never vote for a black as president has fallen dramatically. And look, he is president.
But that's why I'm asking how this has become and why we saw these depictions of our president in this march, you know, that took place here in Washington.
I think we're also having a separate debate, and that is the debate over civility and the way we treat our president, the public discourse, the way we talk to one another. We see cable TV shows sort of amplifying the most extreme voices. And that kind of discourse just wasn't occurring in decades past. You wouldn't attack a president that way. There would be a certain level of respect for the office of the president.
Well, if you go back, for example, to the Lincoln administration, you have him being depicted as a gorilla. Let us not forget those images, the hatred that poured out. But now you've got Congressman Joe Wilson screaming out, "You lie," as the president addressed a joint session of Congress. Did the Democrats do Joe Wilson a favor by rebuking him?
Well, maybe. I mean, certainly he's a celebrity. He's raising money, and he's got a following now that he certainly didn't have before.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show, and the GOP is calling these efforts at retribution hypocrisy.
Because they'll point out that a lot of rotten things were said about Bush when he was a president as well. But to my knowledge, nobody ever called him a liar in a joint session of Congress. But I think to your last question, I think, there's always discretion in here. And the Democrats had a choice. Are we going to leave it at his apology to the president, or are we going to push it further? And they did push it further. And I think it may have actually been some benefit to Joe Wilson's base. And I think that's another aspect that sets the present apart from some prior eras, is that in part because of the polarization of our politics and because the internet and cable television allows niche groups to have a much bigger megaphone than they used to, there is in some sense more return to being extreme and uncivil in your discourse.
I want to ask you all about the Acorn controversy. John Dickerson, what's this all about?
It's an extraordinary story. Acorn is a community-based organization that helps poor people in a wide variety of ways. It's long been a target of conservatives because they have claimed that Acorn has, and in fact they've had some basis, though not as much as they've claimed, that Acorn in voter registration has basically created phony registrations for people. And Acorn, in fact, has been caught, but again, not as much as conservatives claim. But I'm burying the lead here, which is that we have one filmmaker, activist, went into some Acorn offices in New York, Baltimore, Washington, and in California, and posed as pimps and prostitutes, asking for assistance in bringing underage Ecuadorian girls to set up a prostitution ring. And they were the video is extraordinary entertainment, and one's jaw drops as these Acorn employees across the country give them advice on how to do this, how to claim that prostitution is actually a performance art, how to claim the underage prostitutes being brought in from Ecuador as dependents, how to hide the cash gains from this. It's extraordinary video, and this has led to the House and Senate denying federal funding to Acorn, and it will, of course, lead to more as well.
Cheryl.
Yes, and it also is a problem, again, for the president. President Obama was a community organizer, and as we know, he, as a lawyer in the 1990s, represented, I think, an affiliate of Acorn in a lawsuit. And Republicans have always tried and did try during the 2008 campaign to tie Acorn to the president. And this is an unsettling development. And we saw yesterday at the White House, Robert Gibbs, the president's press secretary, being questioned about it and having to stand up there at the podium and say, well, clearly this behavior on the part of Acorn employees is unacceptable. The White House doesn't want questions like that.
Here's an email from Dell in Florida who says, why did Acorn's leader claim the sting was wrong and false, and yet she fired the Acorn workers? Very contradictory. You can't have both. Can't have it both ways.
Right, exactly. And they've claimed that the video was doctored and so forth, but you can't doctor the video in a way that...
Only so much.
Thank you, Diane. Exactly. You can only doctor it so much. And what's extraordinary here is that it's not just one bad apple. It's that, now, in some cases, we should say, the gentleman posing as a pimp and the prostitute were turned away at some Acorn offices. But in several, in lots of different places, it was they were admitted, and the conversation had none of the awkward pauses you might think you'd have if you were talking to a pimp and a prostitute. They seemed to be out of a manual or handbook as they provided guidance and assistance.
I think that, one could say that an organization as large as Acorn, which has over 1,000 chapters, there's always going to be some bad apples. But I think it is a little disturbing that these two people were able to find so many bad apples.
I have to say, I think it clearly raises questions in my mind about the culture of the organization. Every organization has a culture. We impose, at my newspaper, certainly very stringent ethics rules from the top. Everybody who works there knows that if you violate them, you're in trouble. So, you know, what was going on?
Cheryl Gaze Stolberg of the New York Times, John Dickerson of Slate and CBS, Greg Ipp of The Economist. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup. President Obama scraps the U.S. missile shield program in Eastern Europe. The administration defines how it will measure U.S. success in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And an Indonesian raid kills Southeast Asia's top al-Qaeda leader. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back, and now we'll open the phones first to Spencerport, New York. Good morning, Hal. You're on the air.
Okay, I just wanted to report that Rolling Stone reported that Max Baucus received more than $2 million, I believe it was $2.13 million, from health insurance companies and prevented anyone from speaking. There were several people who wanted to speak on single-payer health insurance.
Any comments, John Dickerson?
Well, I would say that on the question of single payer, without directly having the Rolling Stone piece in front of me, they didn't need Max Baucus to block it. The president of the United States is not advocating for single payer, and it was never a serious part of the health care reforms as they went forward in the House or the Senate.
Any other comments?
And on the question of insurance company contributions, I hasten to say I'm shocked that a member of Congress received money from the insurance companies. I mean, this, you know, let's face it, lobbyists are out in full force on this issue, and we know that. And we know that they contribute money to politicians' campaigns, so it's no surprise.
All right, let's go to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Matthew. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Thank you for the show. This
sure.
is great.
Good.
I wanted to mention something about the speed of healthcare reform legislation. I think TARP, we learned a lesson in going too quickly. There were a lot of little things we would have changed if we'd moved a little slower. I realized people, you know, that it was an emergency, but even a few weeks. I think what people are finding is the price of healthcare is rocketing. I know my company, we had a 23% increase in healthcare costs. And the next year they said, good news, it's only 8%. Mm. The response was, are you kidding? You raised it 23. You should say it's going down 17, right? I mean, this is kind of insane. And what happened was we as a company pushed back and said, no, we need to see the reasons. Please justify it all. And they acted as if they'd never heard that before. And lo and behold, they come back, and now it's a 2% increase. Obviously not the best thing in the world, but I think because things are hitting the wall and because the whole nation is awake to this issue, it seems to give it a little more time. I realize election cycles, you want to get something done before momentum fails, but it seems that a little more time letting everyone start to actually interact, company and group to healthcare HMO and health insurance company. We're finding a lot of things, and other people I know, that this sort of pushback and an actual dialogue where the people who are most involved, i.e., the people who need the health care, are getting under the hood.
All right. And Greg Ebb.
Well, I would take issue with his comparison to the TARP program. I mean, the TARP program, which was $700 billion appropriated to essentially bail out the failing financial system, was done basically in an emergency situation where we literally had weeks before the entire system melted down. The fact that it didn't exactly work out perfectly, that a lot of things we got wrong, is not entirely shocking. We were doing a lot of things this country has never done before, at least not since the 1930s. On healthcare, and Cheryl will correct me on this, there isn't a lot more we're going to learn by waiting another year or two about what our options are. Almost all the things that we're talking about are things that have been talked about, studied, tried on pilot basis at the state level and so forth. If there is a reason to wait, and it doesn't really have to do with the merits of the particular reform program, it's the potential that the fiscal deficit situation facing the country is going to push everything else to the side and that we aren't doing enough yet to deal with that.
Cheryl.
Well, I think Greg is absolutely right that there is not really much more we're going to learn about how to change the healthcare delivery system, how to bring down costs. We know what to do. The question is getting the political consensus around doing it. And the two words that the caller used that were very important were election cycle. Let's face it, once we head into the 2010 election cycle and we're getting close to being there, it will be that much more difficult for the president to pass reform. He knows that he's got to act now because of politics. That is a fact here in Washington, and it's the way to get things done.
Here's an email from Donna who says, what can the average citizen do about all the racial fear-mongering on talk radio? This is very harmful, gets worse each day. Talk radio can call the president a racist, a terrorist, and much more. How can we get these people to shut up? Of course we can't. They are, she says, they are the real terrorists and causing more and more hate each day. I lived through the 60s, and it feels like it did during the civil rights era. John Dickerson.
Well, at a personal level, you know, you can engage the listeners or people you know who are listeners. But one thing that strikes me is that there's an opportunity here for a conservative leader to do what Hubert Humphrey did when he was running against Jack Kennedy, and there was talk of anti-Catholic voting, and he said. And maybe it was self-aggrandizing, but it doesn't matter. He stood up and said, I don't want a single anti-Catholic vote to help me win in these primaries in 1960. And it seems to me there is an opportunity for a conservative leader as the party, particularly as the Republican Party in particular, tries to build its base outside of this core of conservatives to stand up and say, we will not tolerate this kind of behavior and discussion. And I know people's tempers are flared for a variety of reasons that I may agree with, but we're better than this, and the movement is better than this. And no one has done that. And it's an adult moment for someone to seize that they haven't.
I was thinking, listening to John speak, I'm reminded of the moment during the campaign when there was a lot of anger bubbling up over then-candidate Obama, and it was spilling out into John McCain's town hall sessions, and some questioners talked to Senator McCain and said, you know, I'm not going to vote for him, I'm afraid of him, and Senator McCain said, you know, I'm sorry, there's no need to be afraid. You know, he was trying to take a leadership position and sort of tamp it down.
That's right. He did, and then he was booed for it.
Right.
Right. Still but, going on.
But he tried.
Still going on. Let's go to Oklahoma City. Good morning, Sarah. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you so much for having me on.
Sure.
You were talking a little bit about the president's speech at the University of Maryland, and your panelist said something about how young people are, we see ourselves as the young, healthy generation. Even the president called us invulnerable. And I don't think that it's that we don't want health insurance. I think it's that we're graduating with huge amounts of student loan debt, and entry-level jobs, if you can find them, tend to not come with a benefits package. You know, we want health insurance, we just can't afford it. And I think unless the Congress and the White House passes a meaningful public option, they will have done nothing for young people.
Great.
Well, that's an excellent point. I mean, a lot of the plan hinges on making some people pay more. And one of those groups is the healthy uninsured. And there was a good quote, actually, in a Wall Street Journal article. It was an individual in Massachusetts who's been paying $1,000 a year in penalties because he hasn't joined the Massachusetts program. And he's really upset about it. He's saying, I can't afford the plans that are out there. It's like penalizing a homeless person for not buying a mansion. And I think that there are a lot of people who might end up feeling that way. But I also think it's important to point out that even if you're paying this penalty, you do get something in return. You get a much better safety net, and you get higher assurance that when the time comes that you will need care and insurance, it'll be there.
I also think a lot of young people are questioning this, but the economics of it for the insurance industry depend on bringing in that pool of healthy young people. That is the way that the industry can make the numbers work so that it can expand coverage to those who are sick and who need it.
Let's talk about the fact that Massachusetts Senate is taking up a bill today that would allow Governor Deval Patrick to appoint an interim successor to Senator Kennedy. The bill was approved by the Massachusetts House of Representatives yesterday by a vote of 95-58. All 16 Republicans voted against the bill. Chances in the Senate, John?
I think the chances in the Senate are that it will pass and Deval Patrick will sign it. The backstory from Washington on this is that David Axelrod, the president's senior advisor, and others in the White House have been working to get this moving along because Deval Patrick will appoint a Democrat. It will provide that crucial 60th vote for Democrats, which would then in the healthcare debate be very helpful if they want to do this as a purely Democratic Party thing. They would have the 60 to defeat a filibuster in the Senate.
I gather Michael Dukakis is one of the people under consideration for that post.
He is, and the promise that would be exacted from the person taking that post is that they would not then run in the special election. So it would be a caretaker position for whoever embraced it.
Right. Sure. This was, of course, Senator Kennedy's dying wish that his seat be filled. Of course, Senator Kennedy spent his career trying to press the case of universal insurance. The last thing he wanted was for his death to be the one vote that stands in the way of it.
All right. To Fairfax, Virginia. Hi there, Lynn. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. I'm not sure my sense of history is correct, but it seems to me that the back in either the Nixon or the Reagan administration, there was a plan to have more support in the South by focusing on racism and using that to also focus against government in general. And when I have pictures come to mind about the question of racism, I see the very young students trying to go to high school with the marshals around them, and most importantly, the white teenagers and their parents just jeering and yelling and insulting these children. And I just wonder if the confusion between racism and the government as evil is continuing, and that there's just not an acknowledgement that tie-in exists.
Interesting.
Well, your sense of history is right. I mean, it starts with LBJ when he signed the Civil Rights Act, said we just lost the South, and Nixon ran on or used the so-called Southern strategy to when you, as a Republican, talked about crime in the cities, it was a code for African Americans and building up support among some even conservative Democrats. But that's history, and I don't think anybody here is denying that there is racism and that there is this conflation, and maybe even in the South. Again, a lot of what people are pointing to is that the Republican Party is right now strongest in the South. But we're talking about magnitude here, and the question, it seems to me, we have to figure out is how much is this conflation going on in a large group, or is it there is always going to be a hard nut of opposition in any instance against a president? And it's been throughout American history. And Richard Hofstadter wrote about the paranoid style in American history that has been with us forever. The question is this a big group or is it a small group, and is it getting bigger or not?
But that's why I wonder about the fueling of the polls that come out. You said, Cheryl, the president remains popular, but somehow these angry voices are making themselves heard in such a way as to say the president himself may be okay, but his programs are all wrong.
Well, I do think in this discussion of racism, we do have to take a step back and remember that there is genuine philosophical opposition to the president's policies. There is a genuine sense among people out in the country that government is doing too much, that the era of big government is back, and they don't like it. So I would hate for us to leave this program and create the impression that all of the anger and opposition to President Obama is fueled by racism. There's clearly upset over his policies.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Hi there, Rich. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I just wanted to point out a study that was just released today from, and it was reported in Reuters, and it's in the American Public Health Association, a Harvard study that links 45,000 U.S. deaths every year due to lack of health insurance to people under age 65. In no other industrialized country would we allow 45,000 people to die because they lack health insurance, not to mention the fact we have over 700,000 people a year claiming bankruptcy due to lack of health insurance or health-related costs. In no other industrialized society would we allow that. How can we even think that we don't need health care reform considering those statistics?
Quite a mouthful.
It is, and I think it goes to the issue we were chatting about a few minutes ago with respect to young people asking, what's in this for me?
Sure.
And one of the interesting thrusts that the administration has taken is to try and explain how the nature of our healthcare system is that people who think that they're fine, you know, someday because of like an unexpected catastrophe are not fine. The Treasury Department did a study that found that most people, about half of Americans, will at some point go without health insurance. And that's the kind of vulnerability that leads to the sorts of, you know, tragedies that the caller was talking about.
And I would just say on that figure, it's striking, and there are many striking figures in this debate, but we're kind of beyond that because there's only a small group of people who say we don't need to reform the system at all, though there's that group is sometimes made to seem larger in the political conversation. Lots of people think we need to change the system. Lots of people are swayed by those numbers. The problem is they haven't – nobody agrees yet on the cure. They agree that it's a problem. They agree it's getting worse every day. The problem we're having now is figuring out how to settle the cure, and that's sort of where the conversation
but,
is now.
But, John, you cannot forget the fact that you've got Republicans saying, wait. You've got to wait. You can take more time. As President Obama said, he knows there have been many presidents who'd like to reform this system. He'd like to be the last.
Right. Well, he won't be the last, but it was a good piece of rhetoric on his part.
It was a good line.
Yeah. Yes, indeed, Republicans are saying wait, but what they're not saying is don't do anything. Now, it's a delay tactic, but I'm trying to separate the difference between those people who say delay, let's do it right, even though they may be wrong in their assessment, delay and do it right versus those people who say we don't need to do anything at all.
Well, they are saying let's start over. They're saying the public is telling us we need to start over. Now, that may be code for not do anything because they know that if they start over, the chances of doing something are slim.
Cheryl Gay-Stoberg of the New York Times, John Dickerson of Slate.com and CBS, Greg Ipp, U.S. economics editor for The Economist. Thank you all so much. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.